This is News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon on today's roundtable. Jefferson says he's not going anywhere, and the prison population is on the rise. Joining us today to discuss these topics and more from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Roland Martin joins us. He's the executive editor of the Chicago Defender. He's at our Chicago Bureau. And in our New York Bureau, John McWhorter, Manhattan Institute Senior Fellow in Public Policy. All right, folks, we talked about this last week, and as it has continued to make headlines, we heard from embattled Louisiana Congressman William Jefferson, who's being investigated on bribery charges. Let's take a listen to what he had to say yesterday.
There are two sides to every story. There are certainly two sides to this story. There will be an appropriate time and forum when that can be explained and explicated. But this is not the time, this is not the forum, and operating on advice of counsel, I will not get into facts.
Congressman Jefferson obviously saying he can't say much of anything, but wanted to come out and make a statement as this story continues to grow. The FBI suggesting that they have the congressman on videotape accepting $100,000 from an informant. It is later said that the money was recovered from his Washington, D.C. residency. Mary Frances Berry alleged to have been held in the freezer wrapped in aluminum foil.
Yes, and, it was cold cash. I've known Jeff for Congressman Jefferson for a number of years in politics around town, and he's been an effective legislator, but it's time for him to resign. He needs to resign so that somebody else can run for his seat. If he's ever vindicated, it will be in court. Things look bad for him now. The only technical aspect of it that's left over that he might argue is the constitutional problem with them going to his offices on the Hill, which violates separation of powers and has never been done in the history of the Republic, which his lawyer might use, and it makes you wonder why they had to do that. They may need some other piece of evidence to actually tie him to actually doing something for the money. But I think that whatever happens, whatever is the outcome, if he cares about his constituents in Louisiana, and boy, are they suffering. He ought to get out right now. If he cares about his party, he ought to get out right now. He ought to resign. And if he's ever vindicated, he can run again. I think his sister has just been elected to the city council again, re-elected to the city council. So if he has a political future, it's going to be after a trial, and he's ruining things for both the people in his district and for the his party. He should go.
Roland Martin, I am sure that the congressman would suggest, even someone who has known him as long as Mary Frances Berry suggests, that, hey, I should be innocent until proven guilty. And as he suggested, there are two sides to every story. And until then, I'm going to continue to walk the walk I've been doing for some time now.
Well, he is correct that you are innocent until proven guilty. But the problem is, how can you effectively represent your district? I mean, we're talking about a region that, of course, has been impacted by Hurricane Katrina. He sits on the House and Ways and Means Committee. And so it's not as if people really want to deal with him and be around him. And so he is a significant liability, not just to the committee, but also to his party. But more importantly, he's a liability to his district.
John McWhorter, we hear and have heard for years the phrase, politics makes strange bedfellows. When you see Dennis Hastert and Bill Frist coming to the aid of William Jefferson in this sense, them suggesting, and this is from Dennis Hastert, the House Speaker, suggesting that the raid of the congressman's office, he believes, probably overstepped constitutional limitations on executive powers. We heard about the separation from Mary Frances Berry just a moment ago. It is interesting to see the fodder that Republicans had used heretofore change ways in the sense that if you break this barrier, they too have an open door that they might one day see FBI agents rummaging through their offices.
Well, of course, and they're extremely worried about these sorts of things because we might have a precedent here. It wouldn't be surprising if we saw this kind of thing happening again, especially given that nowadays so much evidence is of the kind that would be in an office encoded on a computer. But the strange bedfellows question is certainly, or comment, is certainly appropriate here.
But I happen to think that it is an important constitutional question. in the history of the country, and the founding fathers were very aware of the excesses of executive branch of power in England, and they wanted to make sure that there was separation. So this is unprecedented. I can see why Hassert and Frist, even if they aren't worried about anybody going into their offices or some other Republican, would be very concerned that this precedent not be violated, that not be overreaching. At the same time, they're not going to defend Jefferson.
You know, Ed, what also jumps out is that Jefferson made these comments on yesterday, but he held a news conference a week ago in Louisiana that sort of, I mean, I would not be surprised if it raised the ire of prosecutors, because he had the news conference on Monday. Then, of course, all of a sudden we see the partial unsealing of these documents on Saturday. Then you have the raid. And so you sort of had this, I mean, like it or not, you have a PR game that also goes on between the prosecution and the defense. His previous attorneys were discussing a plea bargain. He fired those attorneys, and he's moving forward. Clearly, he's becoming very adamant in his defense. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the prosecution, if the U.S. attorney, releases more information to put the public pressure on him for him to take some kind of plea.
But it's also part of the overreaching generally in this administration to have the temerity to violate over 200 years of history in American politics and our legal system, and to send people up there to Capitol, get the warrant, go up there and do it, even if they were doing it for PR reasons. It's just another example, and that's why Hassert and Frist, I think, are concerned.
Mary, do you think that,
absolutely,
do you think that they were doing it just out of a kind of a wanton lack of regard for the Constitution, or do you think they could justify it in some systematic way?
Well, maybe they weren't thinking about the Constitution. They often don't think about the Constitution, apparently, in the things that they do, because if they did, they wouldn't do some of them. Let us hope. And it may be in their eagerness to also highlight Jefferson, because he's a Democrat, and that is supposed to obscure the ethical problems that they have with, you know, the Abramoff scandal, and do I need to list all of them? Nay, and go on, and Cunningham as an issue for the Democrats. But I think that that kind of a careless overreaching on constitutional questions, which characterizes this administration, is something that will haunt us long after they're gone.
And keep in mind, they said that he accepted $100,000. Cunningham was accused and convicted of accepting $2.8 million, and they never, ever conducted a raid on his office. You know, I'm certainly not defending Jefferson, because when folks say I have a videotape and audio tape and that kind of evidence, I mean, that is very damaging. But again, I think what Hastert and Frist are looking at is, yes, precedent, and whether or not that is fair, because as they even understand, it could be Jefferson today, it could be us tomorrow.
Jefferson also seems to have made it rather easy, given the sorts of things that he did. He was rather easy to smoke out, given these very physical sorts of, you know, almost 1970s cop show sorts
of
things.
Well, alleged to have done, John.
Alleged
to have done.
Alleged to have. Remember Alcee Hastings, who was convicted and left his seat in Congress. He wasn't convicted. He was prosecuted. And later they wanted to impeach him. Remember that whole? He's now
Congressman from Florida
again. That's what I meant when I said that if Jefferson is somehow vindicated, he can run again.
Right.
But right now he needs to leave for the sake of his constituents, and the thing looks terrible for the sake of
his
party.
All right, well, historical and importance of the division withstanding, Mary, I think there are a lot of nervous folk on the Hill just the same on both sides of the aisle when they start going into these offices.
All right,
let's turn our attention to the idea of prison being big business. We've been hearing about that for some time. Here's a statistic, and we have heard of the incarceration rate of African-American males, the disproportionate and high number of African-American males in jails and prisons across this country. But the Bureau of Justice Statistics has released a number of statistics, including prisons and jails adding more than 1,000 inmates each week for a year, putting the population at 2.2 million people. That's one in every 136 U.S. residents behind bars by last summer. John McWhorter.
Well, you know, the way I see that is that, for one thing, there are definitely interests who are interested in keeping the prisons full. Now, I don't think that these are people who are devoted to keeping colored people in prison, but it is better for them if the prisons are full, such as the unions of guards, such as people, Congress people in the districts who know that these sorts of populations technically increase the population of their districts. Those things are unpardonable. And as far as I can see it, the fact that we have this situation and the fact that a lot of this prison population swelling is due to the Rockefeller laws and people committing offenses with possession of and use of drugs. It seems to me that we need to really think about getting rid of this rather peculiar policy, as it'll be seen in history, of having these kinds of criminal prosecutions for drugs. And drugs should be, drugs that hurt people very much, I think, to a large extent, legalized, because whatever harm there would come in the fact that it would be easier for a lot of people to use these kinds of drugs if they were cheaper and if you couldn't make a living by selling them on the street, then I think that there would be a lot less of this sort of thing, such as these swelling prison populations. And it would be easier to do that than to stop inconsiderate people from being interested in having full prisons.
Mary Frances Berry, it seems to me when we tick off these numbers, sometimes we become immune, numb to them almost. But when you think about the highest rated states of prison incarceration, Louisiana and Georgia having more than 1% of their population in prison or jail, that really is an astonishing number.
It has an impact on politics. It has an impact on the communities from which they come. All those people who have benefited from it economically that John talks about, they're happy that if people don't pay attention and become sort of numb when they hear the numbers again. But when you think about the families of the people who are in prison and the communities from which they come, which are already in many cases poor communities, you can think of the heinousness of this policy of doing nothing about the drug situation. And I happen to think that people who are on drugs, who are addicted to them, there ought to be some kind of legalization, some kind of change in policy toward them. It's another thing if they're, you know, selling drugs in large quantities and getting other people addicted. But it's the impact on families. And we keep hearing the numbers over and over again. We talk about the prison industrial complex, and then we don't do anything. The Sentencing Commission recommended a change in the sentencing guidelines. That never happened. There are judges who complain because they've lost their discretion. And we can talk about how much it costs to keep people in prison. We've all made these speeches. But it seems nothing seems to happen.
This also is a red state, blue state issue. If you look at those top five states, as you mentioned, Ed, Louisiana, Georgia, Texas, Mississippi, and Oklahoma, the lowest rates, Maine, Minnesota, Rhode Island, Vermont, and New Hampshire. What you have is in those highest states, you have this attitude of law and order. Who can be the toughest? I mean, I recall a number of years ago with the governor of Texas was running against a challenger, and they had these television commercials and had these huge posters of folks they put to death. And it was like this badge of honor, how many people I've killed when I was governor.
There's also a race role, and look at who the color, you know, there are not many black people in those last states you mentioned.
Yes, wouldn't precisely. It be nice if the prisons could also have better rehabilitation and better opportunities for education so that if they
care about that, John. We don't really care about that. We really don't.
There is a lack of caring about these.
I mean, we get upset when we say, well, people are coming out of the prison and they're committing crimes. Yeah, because you're not rehabilitating. You're not educating. Because when they are in prison, people then say, well, I don't want to have to pay for a prisoner to go to school and to get a degree. Well, you have to make up your mind. Either you're going to accept the crime when they come out, and then when people also come out, you also don't want to hire ex-felons. And so what are you leaving people with the options for? And so there's a stigma attached to it, and I'm not saying that, I'm going to be soft to anybody who commits a crime. You commit a crime and it's heinous, it's time for you to go to jail. But we have to make some very critical decisions. If we're not going to train them, then we're not going to hire them, we might as well accept these prison stats.
And the return of these
quickly,
people to inner city communities.
Let me quickly get to these numbers, John, if you don't mind. Forgive me, but we've only got about 3 minutes to go, and I wanted to get this in very quickly. This out of an article from the San Francisco Chronicle, roughly 10% of Mexico's population of 107 million people is now living in the United States. About 15% of Mexicans' labor force is working in the U.S., and one in every seven Mexican workers migrates to the United States. John, pick up there as we look at this immigration debate. What do these numbers say, if anything?
It's Mexico, frankly. I mean, Mexico has a wonderful, varied topography. It's got all kinds of natural resources. It's got a massive population. And yet, it has the kind of economy where people can actually make 10 times as much money here as there. And most of the reason for that is not because of the world economy. Mexico is blessed with the resources that could make it lucky to be one of the big players. It's because they have a corrupt and elitist kind of society that's never had, even, for example, anything that you could really compare to our great society. society in terms of affecting the lives of the poor. So as a result, you have this massive outflow to the wealthy United States, which there's really nothing that we can do about in any real way. And I find myself just thinking what a tragedy Mexico and its history, particularly over the last about 100 years, is.
And it's also the case that you could look at it with these numbers, that it's a national security issue, immigration, that we don't want a country on our border at the south, Mexico, that's engaged in turmoil and who is hostile to us and all the rest of it. And if you had all those people pent up there, you might have the kind of political change that we wouldn't like. And so having them all come here, which creates all kinds of problems here in the United States that have to be resolved, and we seem to have no policy for in terms of economic competition and all the things that we've talked about before. But it seems like the safety valve, this is a safety valve for Mexico, letting all these people come here, and it's a security of our borders issue for the United States.
And here's a point that I've long argued, which is why I was talking about, you know, President Vicente Fox. The story you're talking about, Ed, says Mexico received a record $20 billion in remittances from migrant workers that is equal to Mexico's 2004 income from oil exports and dwarfing tourism revenue. Look, we're simply an outpost. Vicente Fox recognizes the amount of money they're sending back. If you go, look, I'm born and raised in Texas, and I can tell you, you go to San Antonio and you look at the dollars that are being transferred back. That's why when people talk about the spending power of Latinos and what's happening in America, look, the money is going back to Mexico, to Colombia, to other countries, and that's why these presidents, they don't want that fence. That's why they're fighting tooth and nail, because they recognize their economy is contingent upon these workers crossing the border and sending the money back home.
Yeah, the genie is truly out of the bottle, and it is not going to change. We're going to have to continue to watch this story, and it'll be interesting to see how Washington plays itself out with all of that, Roland Martin, as you put forth to grapple and deal with. Roland, John, Mary, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Next up on News and Notes, NPR Special Africa correspondent Charlene Hunter-Galt takes us inside the headlines from Africa, and the group Imani Winds brings a soulful twist to classical music. Thank you.